and open your Bibles, please, to Ruth chapter 3, verse 1. Someone has said that trust means believing that what God says is true enough to act like it. I think that's a very convicting definition of trust. I think it's convicting because it's not a kind of trust that gets to sit on the sidelines. It's not a kind of trust that gets to stay in the brain, that gets to hide out in the safe shelter of the mind only. I think that's a safe kind of trust. We all know that kind of trust, but this definition requires a person to do something, and it's usually something risky. What do I mean? Well, you've probably all heard the example of a chair used to illustrate trust. Maybe not if you haven't. A person looks at a chair and he says that he believes that chair can support the weight of a human being. They say, yeah, that chair will hold me up. Is that trust? Well, it's a form of trust, but mainly that's just an assertion, and a pretty safe one, because you're still standing up when you say it. It's just an intellectual agreement that requires nothing of you. So what does real trust look like in that case? Well, it looks like that person actually going and sitting on the chair. That's trust. I've also used the example of the person who's unicycling back and forth across over Niagara Falls on a tightrope. He does this several times in front of an awestruck crowd. Then he turns to them and he says, look, you know, that's nothing. He says, I could even do that with someone on my shoulders. Well, you probably see where I'm going here. He says to them, how many of you believe that? And almost everybody raises their hand. They're real enthusiastic. Is that trust? Well, yeah, not in its fullest. Once again, that's a safe on the sidelines sort of intellectual agreement. So what does trust look like in that case? Well, it looks like you volunteering to be the person who climbs up to sit on the unicyclist's shoulders. Not me, someone says. Trust means believing what is said enough to act like it. And that almost always involves some sort of risk. What does that have to do with our series today on the book of Ruth? Well, so far we've been introduced to three main characters. We've been introduced to Naomi and Ruth, and very briefly to Boaz. And what we've seen in the last two chapters, as well as what we'll see today, is that despite their flaws, each of these characters ultimately trust that God's covenant love applies to them. They each believe that the God of Israel has committed himself to them, to love them in a loyal way, similar to how a husband commits to a special kind of love for his wife. They've sought the Lord in different ways, and they trust him because, why? Well, because he's not forsaken them, but has rescued them and been a stronghold for them and has blessed them. And here's the connection. The way we know that they really trust God and his love for them is because they're willing to act like it in ways that involve risk. If God says being under his covenant love means refuge and safety, means provision and blessing, means hope and rest, both now and forever, then his people can risk surrendering and sacrificing certain things that they normally wouldn't. Things like popularity, things like personal preferences, things like comfort and convenience, even safety. Why would they be willing to sacrifice these things? Well, because they found something better, and they know that their future is secure. And so really the big idea or theme of our text today is that those who trust in God's loyal covenant love are willing to take risks. And this morning we're going to look at we're going to look at five risks. I don't think we're going to get through all five. We left Ruth last week, if you remember, about to head down to the threshing floor. Naomi has come to her at the end of the harvest season with a plan to get her married. You remember that out of her own loyal love for Naomi, Ruth had already sacrificed any plans of getting remarried. And she planned instead to do what? She planned on spending the rest of her life looking after her aging mother-in-law. That's why she left her home and she left her family and she left her gods and said those famous words that we probably all know, where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts me from you. Those are amazing words of commitment from Ruth. But in the week since that declaration, we've seen that, well, Naomi's seen, finally, she has seen, she's become aware of God's hand at work in the way that her relative, Boaz, has treated Ruth with obvious favor. He's been paying special attention to her, and she's realized that certain of God's laws just so happen to line up perfectly with the timing of their arrival back in Bethlehem and with the man who's taken a special interest in her daughter-in-law. She's realized that he's a man who not only qualifies to marry Ruth, but a man who could also provide redemption, who could provide rescue from their distress and an outpouring of good for her family in ways that she hardly dares hope. And that's because he's what's called a redeemer. There was a law that said the closest male relative to a widow's deceased husband was able to marry that widow and care for her, could even produce an heir to perpetuate the name of the dead husband so that that family estate could be redeemed instead of sold off or lost. And so Naomi starts to formulate a plan of marriage and of redemption. You know, watch out when mothers-in-law get thinking and planning. Last week we saw that Naomi, though, got concerned because, you know, she had Ruth and she had Boaz together harvesting in this field for about 2 months, but she gets concerned because the harvest season had come and gone, a nearly two-month period, you know, daily contact between these two, and still neither of them had made the first move. Just this game of chicken going on here. Boaz has held back, we said, because his dignity and restraint keep him from being anything but virtuous and gentlemanly. So this could be for any number of reasons. First, as we'll see confirmed today, Boaz knew that Ruth didn't technically have to seek out a kinsman redeemer, but she could have married she could marry a younger man if she wished. And so, you know, maybe he didn't want to interfere or pressure her in any way. He's much older than she is, and so the last thing he wants, we said, is to be perceived as doing something improper or dishonorable or creepy. Second, as we'll also see confirmed today, Boaz knew that there was another relative in Bethlehem even more closely related to Ruth's dead husband than himself. And so maybe he was courteously holding back so the other man could step in if Ruth did want to seek a kinsman redeemer to marry. Finally, as commentator Daniel Block suggests, it's possible Ruth was, as she was working in the fields, it's possible she was wearing some signs of mourning. Maybe, you know, some sort of dress that signaled mourning, maybe some headdress. And so as an upright man, he says, Boaz would not violate a woman's right to grieve the loss of her husband, nor impose himself upon her until she was ready. And so maybe for one or all of those reasons, Boaz feels like any advance on his part would just be inappropriate. For her part, Ruth also hasn't made any moves, we said. Maybe, as we said last week, it's because she's super aware that Boaz is in many ways out of her league, right? He's a native Israelite and she's a foreigner, a Moabite. He's a rich and important man and she's a poor widow. She's a nobody. He's the boss. She's a lowly gleaner. She's a servant. So even though the laws for redemption, you know, can technically be applied to her, those extra factors mean she doesn't exactly feel entitled. And so it's possible any advances on her part also seem really inappropriate. And so there's this stalemate. And so last week we saw Naomi finally step in to play matchmaker and overcome this impasse. And so we left off with daylight fading and with Naomi having just laid out her plan. She said that she knows where Boaz is going to be that night, and it's a unique opportunity for privacy. And so step one, Ruth is to take a bath, we said. Step two, she's to put on some perfume. Step three, she's to get dressed. And, you know, if not in something fancy, then at least in something that no longer signals widowhood or mourning. All of these actions, writes one commentator, are designed to make Ruth as attractive to Boaz as possible and to break down resistance. I like how that's put. You're going to break this stalemate. And finally, step four, Ruth is to go down to the threshing floor and present herself to Boaz in a very specific way that signals her desire for him to be her husband. She's being a little bit forward here, but she's, you know, desperate times and desperate measures and all that. So she's to sneak to a place that is outside. I mean, set the scene in your mind. She's to sneak to a place outside of town without being seen. She's to let Boaz finish his evening meal. She's to mark which one of those very few people gleaning is him so that she doesn't confuse him for someone else, because that would be really awful. And she's to wait till he's asleep, and then she's to creep down there to the threshing floor under the cover of darkness and fold back his robe in a way that uncovers his legs or part of his, or just his feet, all before lying down there to sleep at his feet. Then, Naomi said, he will tell you what to do. That's the plan. The big idea or theme of our text today is that those who trust in God's loyal covenant love are willing to take risks. Well, what kind of risks? First, such trust risks submitting to earthly authorities. Look now at verse 6. So she, Ruth, went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. It says commanded her there. I heard from someone this week who was wondering sort of, you know, how does Ruth feel about all this? You know, it's easy for us guys, maybe we're reading through a story like this and we're like, yep, this sounds logical, this is all going great, but how does Ruth feel? In other words, is Naomi just forcing her hand by playing matchmaker here? Does Ruth get any say in this matter? Does she even want to marry this old man named Boaz? You know, these are, I think, legitimate questions. And so first, I think we need to remember, this is a very different culture from ours, with very different values and priorities. I think it's safe to say that the ideal life for a woman in our day doesn't look like it did back then. And maybe you don't understand completely what I mean. In short, in our day, many women see marriage and children and motherhood as impositions and inconveniences instead of blessings, as hurdles to jump, as regressive ideals to avoid, as obstacles and shackles to be, you know, cast off in pursuit of new cultural priorities like personal autonomy, the authentic self, and professional career goals. Now, that seems to be more the priorities of our day, so that even if modern women do decide to get married, they tend to get married in our day later in life, and for reasons that have more to do with convenience and fun than with security and the raising of children. I think I looked at a statistic, even since 2020, the year 2000, in the last 25 years, the age for marriage of both men and women has been pushed back 6 years on average. So they're waiting longer, and usually for different reasons. And so while many women still prioritize traditional family roles, they're simply not in the majority anymore in our culture. In fact, as recently as 2022 and 2023, and really a significant cultural shift, two studies came out showing that young men actually express a greater interest in marriage and children now than do young women. That's a big change. That would have been, in biblical times, though, that would have been unheard of. Marriage and children and motherhood, in biblical times, those were core identity markers for women. Marriage and children and motherhood were seen as the defining achievements of womanhood. By contrast, to be unmarried or a widow in biblical times was, by definition, to be poor, to be pitiful, and to be preyed upon. Leon Morris writes that the lot of an unprotected widow in the ancient world could not but be a hard one. Marriage would alter that, and so it would be well with Ruth. And so that place of rest, remember we talked about Naomi seeking a place of rest for Ruth, that place of rest, that place of security and provision and fulfillment that a woman would expect to find in the home of a loving husband, that's something a woman in Israel longed for, as one commentator put it, and that would include Ruth. She would long for that, which means the primary question on Ruth's mind wouldn't be whether she thought Boaz was cute or whether she enjoyed his personality, although that's definitely important. Those would, I think, be more bonuses, you know. She already knows he's an eligible bachelor. That's the primary thing. He's unmarried, and he's a godly man in character. But even better, he's a relative of her dead husband. He's a redeemer. So the real question now is whether there's a chance he will be willing to rescue her from the hardships and insecurities of widowhood, which by extension would also bring blessing to Naomi and to the family name. All that being said, though, yes, I do, to answer that question I got this week, yes, I do think Ruth actually wanted to marry Boaz. And I think we'll see the proof of that later in verse 9, where she speaks her own mind instead of just doing whatever, just strictly what Naomi says. She speaks her own mind in a way that lines up with Naomi's plan of redemption and even exceeds it, and does so in a way that clearly hopes Boaz will respond well. You know, there's a similar question I've heard. I don't know if you have heard this. There's a similar question people ask about the story of Jesus from time to time. It reminds me of a common complaint. There's a common claim about the plan of salvation that I've heard time to time. And the gist of the claim is that God the Father basically forced Jesus to submit to him. Have you ever heard that? I hear that all the time, that God the Father overruled the desires of God the Son, and basically forced him to come down to earth to live and die for his people, for his bride, the church, whether he wanted to or not. And so some have even gone so far as to call the plan of redemption, you know, they're assuming that God the Father has forced God the Son, and so they call the plan of redemption divine child abuse. After all, did Jesus get any say in the matter, they'll say? Did he even want to rescue us and be wed to us? And I just want to encourage you by assuring you that the Bible clearly teaches again and again and again that the plan of salvation, the plan of redemption, was a fully Trinitarian plan. Meaning that just as with Ruth and Naomi, it was equally agreed upon as the best thing by all parties. Every member of the Godhead willingly signed on to the plan of redemption from eternity past. The Father willingly sent the Son. The Son willingly came to pay the penalty to rescue us from our sin. And the Spirit willingly applied all the perfectly successful work of God the Son to His people in a way that perfectly saves them, is saving them, and will save them fully. And so just as Jesus fully submitted to and trusted the commands of His Father while coming down to carry out His plan to save us, so this summary statement in verse 6 tells us that Ruth treats the instructions of Naomi as commands and submissively obeys them. So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law commanded her, the text says. R. Hubbard Jr. calls it unquestioning obedience. You know, submission is never easy. Anybody agree? Unless you really want to do it. Usually, it's not easy. Yielding our will, the beautiful thing is when we fall in love with Jesus, submission becomes easier and easier. But part of our human nature really is not wired for submission. Our human nature is not comfortable with yielding our will to another person's will. We're wired primarily as sinful human beings to trust ourselves. But Ruth submits to her mother-in-law as a God-given authority, and she acts according to what she said. And that's because Ruth trusts her mother-in-law's desire to do what's best for her. But more importantly, Ruth submits to her mother-in-law's plan because she trusts her mother-in-law's God, who has said in Exodus chapter 20, verse 12, "Honor your father and mother, so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. You know, the Bible goes on to tell us more broadly in Romans 13 that there is no, these are terrifying words a little bit, there is no authority except that which God has established. Think about that for a minute. In other words, whether it's a parent or a teacher or a boss or whoever's in power in government, anyone in a position of authority over you has been given that right to rule by God. What that means for you is that unless you can show how obeying such an authority is forcing you to break God's law, you must obey them. Or else, the one you're really disobeying is who? God Himself. And you know, even as I say that, I realize it sounds super risky. It sounds super risky. And of course, again, there are exceptions. But the bottom line is that those who trust in God and His loyal love can take such a risk, submitting to earthly authorities because they know and trust that God is ultimately in control. He knows what He's doing, and God will be honored by that submissive, trusting obedience. We come now to the second risk, which is really going to take up most of our time today. Those who trust in God's loyal covenant love are willing to take risks. In our case, first, such trust risks submitting to earthly authorities, and now, second, such trust risks misunderstanding. Look now at verses 7 through 9. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. Verse 8. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over. Behold, a woman lay at his feet. He said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." So again, let's set the scene. Boaz, he works hard all afternoon and on into evening, winnowing his grain. It's possible this is something he doesn't normally do in person. Maybe he normally has his servants do this, but he's doing it in person, which is why Naomi has stressed, perhaps, that tonight is the night this has to go down. Whatever the case, when his work is done, he's done with his work, he sits down and enjoys a well-earned meal, most likely supplemented by some of his very own grain. So that when he goes to lie down and sleep by the heap of grain that is the work of his hands, the text says his heart was merry. Warren Wiersbe writes that most people today live separated from the sources of their daily bread and don't realize all that's involved in producing food. Perhaps, he says, our table prayers would be more joyful and more grateful if we did. You know, if we did realize what all went into producing our food. Well, you know, I speak from experience. I'm a hunter and my son is a farmer, and I think we've both found what he just said to be true. You don't take your food for granted when you've had a hand in harvesting it. You really value it. Along with the satisfaction anyone would feel at the end of an honest day's work, there's just something special, I think, about enjoying the products of your labor in such an immediate way. It makes your heart merry. And so, basking in the ache of well-used muscles, made merry but also drowsy by the glow of food and wine and the satisfaction of a job well done, Boaz quickly falls asleep there on the threshing floor. Then, the text says, she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. So Ruth has been watching all this, lurking incognito, as one commentator puts it. I like that. From some hidden vantage point, we don't know where she's at, but she's been watching all this, waiting. But what we don't want to think is that the moment Boaz lies down, now she suddenly comes bounding out of her hiding place to come and do this. No, remember that Naomi has told her to observe the place where he lies. What that implies is that she's to wait until he's asleep or until it's completely dark before she approaches. This seems to be confirmed by the way we're told next that she came softly. That can also be translated, she came secretly. She came secretly and uncovered his feet and lay down. So far in the book of Ruth, we've seen all sorts of action unfolding in various in very public places and in the light of day. So this is something new. This feels very different. As R. Hubbard Jr. puts it, the author now shrouds the story in the dark dress of mystery and intrigue. Unlike earlier events, he says, these take place in the dead of night and in utmost secrecy. And it's so dark and it's so secret that Ruth's very identity is veiled. Maybe you noticed that this figure sneaking up to Boaz is just called she, right? It's so dark you can't even tell who it is. She creeps down to Boaz's motionless figure and slowly draws back a corner of his cloak so that his feet and maybe part of his legs are now exposed to the night air. Then she lays down at his feet and she waits. And I think as a Jewish person was reading this, I think they were supposed to gasp at how many things could possibly go wrong with Naomi's plan. Because it was a super risky plan. And maybe you don't understand why, but I will tell you. Because most specifically, this plan ran the risk of massive misunderstanding on many levels. What do I mean? Well, let's just start with the fact that Ruth is a Moabite woman. Don't forget that. And remember that the entire Moabite nation came about because in the absence of husbands after fleeing from Sodom, Lot's daughters got their father blackout drunk and took advantage of him in order to get pregnant. And the son born to Lot's oldest daughter is named Moab. Then, in Numbers 25, the descendants of Moab show up at the time of Moses, and they again draw the people of Israel away from God through sexual immorality. And so this is well-known history to both Israel and Moab. And so even though there's no evidence from our text that Boaz is drunk or that anything inappropriate happens here, just the stigma attached to this woman's people would be a compelling enough reason to discard this plan as a bad idea. This is a bad idea. Because what else would people think if they caught Ruth there? And add to that the fact that these isolated threshing floors at harvest time were places that were already associated in Israel with sexual immorality, according to R. Hubbard Jr. That commentator Daniel Block confirms this. He says, prostitutes, realizing that the men would spend the night in the fields next to the piles of grain, would go out to them and offer their services there at the isolated threshing floors. So again, you know, what else would people think if they caught Ruth there? This is a risky plan. Lots of misunderstanding. Finally, there's the language of uncovering his feet. She came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. Several commentators go to great lengths to point out that there are actually three words used here, uncovered, feet, and lay down, that can all have more than one meaning in certain contexts, all of them sexual in nature. I'm not going to go into all that because the context here in no way justifies an inappropriate reading. If you're reading this carefully in the context, there is nothing inappropriate that happens here. But the point is that a careless reading or a careless hearing of this plan, you know, you're a Jewish person reading this, it would still make its goal sound ambiguous at best and suggestive at worst. Because again, here you have a Moabite woman who has bathed and put on perfume and under the cover of darkness approached a sleeping man at a threshing floor and uncovered his legs. What else would people think if they caught Ruth there? Once more, to say this plan risks misunderstanding is a major understatement. Well, so what happens? Let's look at verses 8 and 9. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. He said, "Who are you?" She answered, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." Elsewhere in the Old Testament, writes one commentator, midnight was a time of momentous events. At that hour, the Lord slew the Egyptian firstborn, Exodus 12:29, and Samson escaped an ambush at Gaza by removing the city gates, Judges 16:3. According to Elihu, death stalks its prey at midnight, Job 34:20. In Jesus' parable, the bridegroom's midnight arrival proved disastrous for the unprepared virgins, Matthew 25, 1 through 13. But here in our story, in this context, there's nothing terrible in the context here that would warrant the King James Version or the American Standard Version translating this as they do. And it came to pass at midnight that the man was afraid. Anybody else have afraid in there? No hands? I know you have that, Eric. The Hebrew word there simply means to tremble or to shake, with no fear implied, as one commentator points out. And so that has to be established from the context, that there is an issue of fear going on here. A little better is what most translations have, including my ESV Bible. At midnight, the man was startled. How many people have startled? I think most people have startled. I think it's reasonable that someone waking up would be startled by a figure near them in the dark. I think that's reasonable. But even then, notice that's not the order that things happen. The presence of a woman isn't noticed until Boaz turns over, which comes after he's been startled awake. So what actually woke him? Well, I think, along with many others, that it was the cold that woke him up. I think it was the cold. His feet have been uncovered now for some time. I don't like it when I wake up and my feet are cold. The night air has cooled, right? It's warm in the evening, but as it gets later in the night, the air has cooled, and I think Boaz has shivered. Boaz has trembled. He's shaken himself awake, and turning over to cover his exposed feet, he suddenly senses a figure laying there in the dark. Behold, a woman lay at his feet, the text says. Well, if it's dark, you might wonder, how does he know it's a woman? Well, my guess is he smelled her perfume. You know, midnight in Moab will give you away every time. So, what does he do? If you weren't here last week, that's a joke. He says this, "Who are you?" It's a logical question. She answered, "I am Ruth, your servant." Boaz can tell it's a woman, but it's so dark, Ruth's identity is still veiled. So he can't see in the darkness to identify her, but the moment he hears her voice, I think he knows it. He recognizes it. "I am Ruth, your servant," she says, and he knows it's really her. And as far as Naomi's instructions go, that's where Ruth was supposed to stop and do whatever Boaz said, right? But instead, she now adds this, "Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." And the million-dollar question is, how will Boaz interpret this? And the reason that's a question at all is because scholars go back and forth about whether or not what Ruth first does, uncovering his feet, and then what she says next, "Spread your wings over your servant," they go back and forth about whether those things are part of some established custom in Israel, some long-standing custom, or if her and Naomi are the ones who sort of come up with this special signal themselves. And the general consensus seems to be that the basic idea, the basic practice itself isn't new. There seems to be evidence from cultures contemporary with Israel that spreading a hem over a woman was the corner of your cloak was sometimes a signal of claiming her in marriage. So I think this would explain in part why Ruth, even though she wasn't born an Israelite, doesn't seem super surprised or confused by this whole plan. And even in the Bible, there seems to be an awareness of this signal or metaphor for protection or marriage or covenant commitment. The Hebrew word my Bible translates wings in verse 9, it's used 34 times in the Old Testament, and the vast majority of the time, that word is just translated wings, like angel wings or bird wings. But the word can also be translated garment or skirt, as in the corner flap or border of a garment. And there's one of these uses in the Old Testament where the word is connected to a scenario of lovers entering into a covenant relationship. That passage is found in Ezekiel chapter 16, verse 8. God, in that chapter, is talking about Israel's helpless state and compares the people of Jerusalem to this abandoned baby who's just been born, just wallowing in blood. It's a gross picture. It's just been tossed out to die. But finding her that way, God takes pity on her and makes her live. Then when she's older, he speaks of marrying her. And this is how God speaks of that event in Ezekiel 16:8. When I passed by you again and saw you, behold, you were at the age for love. And I spread the corner of my garment over you and covered your nakedness. I made my vow to you and entered into a covenant with you, declares the Lord God, and you became mine. So that's a very important passage for understanding what's going on here. And even though that passage may be written after the book of Ruth, the importance of it is in helping establish that what Ruth and Naomi are trying to do here is not to orchestrate some sort of scandalous tryst at the threshing floor in order to get a child or force Boaz to marry Ruth. It's none of that. What they're doing, what they're using, is a legitimate, if rarely used, metaphor in a very literal way to communicate a desire for something noble, right? A desire for marriage and for redemption. But I don't think it's all based on custom. I think it's hugely based on custom, but I also think the choice to use this method at this time as a signal is also based on an interaction that Ruth has already had with Boaz. Maybe you remember it. It's an interaction that included the only other use of this same word for wings in the whole book of Ruth. That was back in chapter 2. When Ruth asked why Boaz had shown her so much favor by giving her special gleaning privileges. After saying it was because of how she's treated Naomi, Boaz went on to say this: a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Now, I think there were two things Boaz could have been saying there. Maybe he's saying both, but at least two things. He could have just been, you know, drawing attention to the fact that by clinging to Naomi and by clinging to Naomi's God, Ruth has also come under the covering of God's protection and his loyal covenant love. Certainly, he's saying that much. But it's also possible that he was saying this, that Ruth has actually taken refuge under the wings of God by coming there to his field. In other words, it's possible Boaz was making a connection for Ruth right in that moment between God's protection and his own protection. It's possible he was sending a subtle signal too, to the best of his fumbling ability. I'm willing to be the permanent, concrete way that God provides for you and protects you. So that maybe Ruth goes home and tells Naomi this strange thing that he said, and for weeks, they've been puzzling and stewing over that, wondering which of the thing he meant. Could he really have been hinting about marriage? Until finally, Naomi snaps her fingers and says, that's it, there's only one way to be sure. Let's use this old custom. You know, it'll be like a subtle signal of our own, so that if we're on the same wavelengths about this, neither of you shy lovebirds will have to hardly say a thing. Right? At the very simplest, you'll just have to go down there and pull back the corner of his robe. And if he's receiving the message, all he has to do when he wakes up is put the corner of that robe back over you. But for whatever reason, Ruth not only does the action, but also speaks her mind. I am Ruth, your servant, she says. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer. Maybe it's nerves, I don't know. But in that moment, she just sort of blurts it all out. As one commentator put it, Ruth is saying, I know, and my mother-in-law knows, that you're the relative who could marry me and give the name of my late husband Mahlon a future, and perhaps more if we had children. I want you to cover me, Boaz, with your wings. All of that, combined with the custom and the law and the previous interactions, all of that should come together in this moment to sound like a marriage proposal. I think that's the goal. But still, this remains super risky. This man has just been woken up from a dead sleep. He's been caught off guard. He's been caught by surprise alone on the threshing floor, and it puts them both in a very compromising situation if anyone catches them, so that a thousand puzzle pieces must be rushing to try and come together at this moment in Boaz's poor mind as he wakes up. And it seems unlikely that all those puzzle pieces are going to find the right place. And so again, the million-dollar question is, how will Boaz interpret this? One possibility, writes John Piper, would be that he wakes up as he has been presented as a godly man, and he drives her away and says, "I thought you were worthy." That would be one possibility, he says. He could say, "Get out of my life. I wouldn't be interested in any woman who would act like that." What's he saying? He's saying, in other words, in his groggy state, he might mistake Ruth's actions as attempted seduction instead of a marriage proposal. It's a risk. That's a risk Naomi's taking, says Piper. Or, he says, there is the possibility that most people would think of, which is that he would look down there, being a man, with her obviously presenting herself, and he simply has sex with her. Both of those are bad ideas, he says. That's not a good plan. So, once again, to say this plan risks misunderstanding is a major understatement. But I think Naomi knows and trusts Boaz, and she trusts Ruth, and she trusts God enough to risk misunderstanding. And the risk pays off because Boaz responds positively, seeming to immediately recognize not only Ruth's voice, but exactly what she means by what she's said and by what she's done. So that instead of rejecting her, he welcomes and receives her gladly. And he said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter." When it comes to misunderstanding, no one has ever risked more than Jesus when he carried out the plan of redemption. And he was misunderstood by many. His parents claim he's the result of a virgin birth. Sure, people say, sure. A king tries to kill him as a baby because he thinks all Jesus came for was his throne. His hometown is Nazareth. Can anything good come from Nazareth, people say, when they hear about him. Even there in Nazareth, after fulfilling prophecy in his childhood synagogue, the people he grew up with dishonor him and try to kill him. And the misunderstandings only grow from there. The Pharisees accuse him of doing miracles by the power of Satan. The crowds think he's come to just feed their bellies. When he corrects them by saying he himself is the bread of life who came down from heaven, and that they must feed on him if they're to live forever. When he says that, they think he's talking about his literal flesh instead of feeding on him by faith. His own cousin, John the Baptist, is temporarily confused about whether or not he's the Messiah at all. Why? Because he's not preaching enough fire and brimstone for John. His own disciples think he's gearing up to lead an armed revolt against Rome and to set up an earthly kingdom there, where they'll all be royalty, sitting on thrones, so that when he dies a disgraced death on a cross, they all think he's failed. So much misunderstanding. Jesus carries out a plan that risked massive misunderstanding at every turn. How did people interpret it? One possibility was that in the end, they mocked him and rejected him and hated him so much that when they couldn't discredit him, when they couldn't ignore him anymore, they killed him to shut him up. But the other possibility was that in the end, those who were part of God's plan for redemption heard the shepherd's voice, and they knew it. They knew it. They recognized him as their Savior and as their King, so that turning from what they were doing before, they received him with gladness instead of rejecting him. We might think of the 12. Jesus calls them, and they hear his voice, and they drop everything to follow him. Peter drops his fishing nets. Thomas drops his skepticism eventually. Simon, his politics. Matthew, his tax collecting. Or we might think of the demon-possessed man who leaves behind his chains, or the two blind men who leave behind a life of begging. We might think especially of the Apostle Paul, like Boaz, also blinded except by the light of the risen Lord instead of by the darkness, so that he too trembling and turning towards a veiled figure, calls out, "Who are you?" And the answer comes back, "I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting." And hearing that voice, Paul knows it. He recognizes him because Yahweh's sheep will always hear his voice and know it. So that after 3 days of darkness, leaving behind his pride and his self-righteousness, Paul too receives Jesus with gladness and walks into the light. And when Jesus hands off the mission to you and I, when he hands off the mission to go into all the world and preach the gospel, the mission to go and make disciples of all nations, the mission to go and tell the world about God's plan of redemption that's fulfilled in Jesus Christ to save those trapped in the darkness of their sins, he knows that you and I are going to face possible misunderstanding too. And we are misunderstood, aren't we? All the time. Out of care for people's souls, we preach Christ's command to repent and believe the gospel, to turn from yourself and from your sin, and turn to Jesus Christ as the only way to be saved. And people think we're teaching self-hate or encouraging low self-esteem, and that's crazy because everyone knows people are basically good, they'll say. Out of care for people's souls, we speak about this sin or we speak about that sin, and people try to hit us over the head with our own Bibles and say, you're being judgmental, they'll say. You're being hypocritical because everyone knows we're not to judge others. Out of care for people's souls, we will warn with Paul, speaking of judgment, that those who refuse to admit their sin and confess it and fight it in their lives, seeking God's mercy and help, those who refuse to do that but instead embrace their sin and defend their sin, we warn with Paul that such people will not inherit the kingdom of God. They won't be saved. And people think we're being mean. And everyone knows Jesus was never mean. Out of a care for people's souls, we remind our family and friends with tears sometimes that love does not rejoice with evil, but delights in the truth. But the moment we start mentioning some of those evil things, especially when those evil things are favorite things of our culture, we're called bigots or haters or fundamentalists, and everyone knows Jesus accepted people just the way they are. So much half-truth in the way people hear what we say. So many misunderstandings. And so the risk of being misunderstood is still going to be very real if you're a Christian. You just need to know that going in. But we're to keep doing what Christ has commissioned us to do. And our assurance is this, our comfort is this, that those who are part of God's plan of redemption will likewise always hear the shepherd's voice in our words, and they will know it. They will know it. It's the promise. They will recognize the voice of Jesus in the preaching of his word, and they will receive him with gladness, and they will follow him. Well, I only got through 2 out of 5 risks today, and so we're going to stop here for now and finish the last 3 risks next time. Those who trust in God's loyal covenant love are willing to take risks. First, such trust risks submitting to earthly authorities. Second, such trust risks misunderstanding. And next time, we'll see that such trust risks putting others first, risks losing good things for the sake of the best, and finally, risks leaving the results in God's hands. For now then, with our thoughts still on the covering of God over the lives of his people, let's close by reading the words of Psalm chapter 5, verses 11 and 12, which is really can be taken by you as a prayer of praise that you can amen in your hearts if you're a Christian. But let all who take refuge in you rejoice. Let them ever sing for joy and spread your protection over them, that those who love your name may exult in you. For you bless the righteous, O Lord. You cover him with favor as with a shield.